Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 74, The Battle of Bennington. Well, here we are. We are finally at the large climactic battle of Bennington that is going to take place in the middle of our Saratoga campaign. It's taken a little while to get here, but this is an extra long episode today where we are just covering the entire battle and what it means for the North American Army, I'm sorry, the Army of the Northern Department, for the Continentals. The battles of Hubbardton and Fort Ann were eye-opening. The Americans still had fight in them, especially in the north. We also talked about how last episode, Schuyler was blocking the roads, felling trees, flooding roads, doing whatever he can. The American commanders have proven themselves a crafty bunch, especially in the northern part of the war so far. Washington has been running, ducking, and hiding and using every tactic possible to escape General Howe while getting his licks in. But in the north, it has been all the American commanders who were running the show. The German mercenaries who augmented Burgoyne's numbers of British troops. Before I get into talking about the Germans, as far as this battle is concerned, I want to just take a second and go over a little vocabulary. Now, people will say Hessians. Everyone calls them Hessians. This is true. A nickname for some German mercenaries were Hessians, provided they were coming from the province of Hesse-Hanau. If we look back in our European history books, Germany does not become a unified state until the 1800s. So in 1777, where we are right now, it's still provinces governed by princes. There's still a Holy Roman Emperor. There's the idea of Germany as a unified state is not there yet. So when we reference them as Hessians, it was just a nickname for those troops that were from the province of Hesse-Hanau. In the fact of the German troops with Burgoyne's army, they were Brunswickers. They were from the province of Brunswick. So that is the small history lesson as far as it goes for the vocabulary of German troops. Occasionally, I'll call them Hessians. It's ingrained in our lessons when we're taught history, when we're taught about the American Revolution. Hessians are a part of it. It's ingrained in us. I'm going to do my best to refer to them as German troops or as Brunswickers, as they're supposed to be. But if I slip up and call them Hessians, at least you know that I'm making an effort. Now, back to where we were. 3,000 or so of the troops that are with Burgoyne's men are German mercenaries. And these were full regiments. They had grenadiers, light troops. They had sharpshooters known as Jaegers. They even had dragoons. The problem was that the dragoons, the German dragoons, that is, had zero horses. And as a cavalry unit, if you don't have horses, well, that's a bit of a problem. They weren't going to bring cavalry horses over the ocean. That would be difficult. And a lot of times the horses didn't survive the trip. So they were going to get cavalry horses from Canada. Problem was there were none available. So the Baron von Riedesel wanted these troops to be mounted. They would be great for scouting, advanced attacks, and they were a definite force to reckon with on the battlefield when they're on horseback. What made the German dragoons difficult to turn into foot soldiers is the fact that the uniforms were definitely a contributing factor to the fact that they couldn't move quickly. They wore thick leather breeches. They had large cocked hats, not that that really would affect movement, but they wore riding boots, tall, thigh-high riding boots. These were going to be reasons why they could not move quickly across the battlefield like other troops could. Then you add to the fact their instruments, their tools of war. They carried large, heavy broadswords, which contributed to their fear factor on the battlefield, that's for sure. They used heavy carbines, and part of their uniform was spurs, which would always get caught on low brush and grass as they were walking around. So the men were pretty much marching in hell as they were trying to make their way through the woods. And Radazel mentions this numerous times to Burgoyne, "I need to get horses for my men." Now that the army was at Fort Edward, Radazel brought it up again, and Burgoyne agreed. He issued very specific and complicated orders that Lieutenant Colonel Baum, the man who was in charge of the Dragoons, or the direct commander of the Dragoons, I should say, would lead an expedition. The only problem is that Baum can't speak a word of English. He only speaks German. Really great idea, having a person who cannot speak English leading English troops. Because with the exception of the 170 so dismounted cavalry and 100 German grenadiers and Jaegers, there would be 300 Canadians. 300 Canadians, Tories, and Indians. Sorry, there was 300 altogether, not 300 of each. Along with 50 of Fraser's marksmen, plus two small artillery pieces, 3-pounders, and crew. All be told, Baum would be in command of about 650 men. Once again, the man cannot speak a word of English, so tell me how that makes sense. To assist Baum, Burgoyne ordered Colonel Philip Skeen. It was the hopes of Burgoyne that Skeen would be there as an advisory capacity, helping Baum make good choices and direct him on the best places to go while they were out on this mission. Remember, the key was to get horses, but they were also looking for other supplies. Burgoyne thought Seth Warner's men would be somewhere near Manchester after the retreat from Hubbardton. And that was what they wanted. They wanted to head to Manchester. Manchester was the largest city in the area. They would definitely have supplies. They would definitely have horses. And there was a good bet that they could take away a possible American fighting force by just showing up in Manchester. They'll either scatter them, or if Seth Warner wanted to put up a fight, well, he could, but he would probably lose. At least that's, the thought process that was going on there. The British were very ignorant to other forces that were in the area, though. And that is going to be the problem. They only think that Seth Warner's Green Mountain Boys are running around. They don't realize that there would be other forces, or don't believe that there would be other forces. So before I continue on in the story, let's take a step back. Let's talk about geography of America. Present day, if you were standing in New Hampshire, you would look to the west and you would see the state of Vermont. In 1776, this was not so. Vermont does not become a state, or does not apply to become its own state territory, until 1777. Before that, it's known as the Hampshire Grants. This territory was a battleground for New York and New Hampshire. We talked about this when discussing Ethan Allen and Seth Warner earlier on. The Green Mountain Boys would gain infamy in fighting for their independence, quote-unquote, from New York and New Hampshire settlers who were encroaching on good Vermont land. By mid-January 1777, the future state of Vermont had declared themselves their own colony. It would not be part of New York or New Hampshire. Of course, 1777 is the middle of the American Revolution, so no one is in New Hampshire or New York is really arguing this point right now. So now as we fast forward to the summer where we are now, Vermont has set itself up with a committee of safety to work as a preliminary and de facto government. But with the looming threat of Burgoyne, they have to turn to an old enemy, New Hampshire. They appeal to the general councils of New Hampshire and New Hampshire and Massachusetts for assistance. New York is right now dealing with the Burgoyne issue on their own, so they knew they couldn't get help there. New Hampshire answers the call. They're going to turn to one of their homegrown heroes, John Stark. Now, Stark is not an unfamiliar name. If you think back to previous episodes, we talked about him as early as Lexington and Concord. After we have the skirmishes at Lexington and Concord, New Hampshire is sending men. John Stark will raise a regiment, and he's going to head to Boston. He was integral in the fight at Bunker Hill. Then he heads north to Canada with Schuyler. The following winter, he found himself in Trenton under the command of General Washington. But when brigadier generals were being picked from the new batch of officers, John Stark is passed over. Now, this is an affront to his honor, and so he will return to his home in New Hampshire. I feel like I've said this before, but it's interesting to see men of honor when they are met with a challenge or met with something that they feel they've been passed over for. They quietly go back to their homesteads and say, I'm retiring from military life. But yet Benedict Arnold does not. I apologize. That was a conspiracy theory that we were just dancing around with one day discussing, saying, hey, you know, what if Peggy Shippen had something to do with Benedict Arnold's betrayal more so than people originally thought? But I digress. That is some conspiracy theory talk that we are going to talk about when we get to that portion of the war. Benedict Arnold is our friend. We love Benedict Arnold. He is a great commander, and he is going to be a good friend to us in the coming episodes. But now back to John Stark. John Stark retires from public life. He says, no, I'm done. If I'm not going to be given the commission that I rightly have earned, and I honestly think that if you go back and just listen to his battles at Bunker Hill in Canada, at least he has garnered that respect to become a brigadier general. We didn't talk too much about Stark during Trenton, but he was still there, still commanding troops. So he will head back to New Hampshire, and good thing he does too, because with the British coming, he's going to get the call to come in and support Vermont. And so on August 8th, Stark would march men to the supply hub at Bennington. He met with Seth Warner, and his Green Mountain Boys and about 200 Rangers were at Manchester. Seth Warner was going to head back up there in case they decided to attack Manchester, but to be ready in case they didn't go to Manchester to come and support Stark. Baum's expedition would begin on August 11th, only 3 days later. He left from Fort Miller, which was about 7 miles down the Hudson from Fort Edward. Just before he left, he received a word from Burgoyne that his first target should be Bennington, getting reports that there is a great deal of supply and horses for the cause. The problem for Baum was his Indian forces. They were scouts. They would lead the way for the expedition. And unfortunately, he had no control over any of them, because they pillaged towns and homesteads and killed livestock. They spread terror throughout the surrounding area. And though that's a great tactic if you're trying to do a slash-and-burn campaign, you actually need things from these areas. So the people of the area were running for the hills, taking all their valuables and supplies with them, and at the same time chasing off their livestock and horses instead of leaving them for the British. It's probably a better prospect to just try and track down your livestock if you can, than knowing that they were in hands of the British Army and it's going to support them and not the Continentals. So it's one of those issues that the people just had to wrestle with. But hearing of these Indian attacks gets Stark moving. He's like, well, now that I know that there are British forces so close, I'm going to send troops out to meet the new threat. And so he sends Colonel Gregg with 200 men to chase off the Indian scouts. Now, he's got an idea of what's coming towards him, but he doesn't know to the full extent. So he sends 200 men. Hopefully, if they chase off the Indian scouts, the British forces will return back to the main army because, well, they have no scouts and they don't know where they're going. So I can see what Stark is planning here. So Greg orders his men to a mill on the Owlkill. There, they would have their first run-in with British forces. Baum ordered his men to take the mill. The Americans fired a volley, then retreated. They destroyed the bridge over the creek. The loss of the bridge would delay the Germans and ensure their defeat, because now the Americans know what's in front of them. It's going to be slow moving for Baum. It takes him a couple of days to get to the Wahlumsack River. There we go. It's a very difficult word to say. That's only about 10, 15 miles away from the mill at the Owlkill. They take the bridge over the river. They camp on a hill that's about a half mile from the bridge. All right, they're going to try and use the high ground to their advantage. Stark has a force of about 2,000 men, while Baum, who got lightly reinforced, has about 800. Rain on the 15th kept the two sides from moving against each other, but around noon on the 16th, the rain stopped and Stark prepares his men for the attack on Baum. Baum positioned the dragoons and half of his marksmen on the hill with one of the three-pounders. Positioned near the bridge were Canadians and some log cabins with 50 German infantry, the other half of Fraser's marksmen, and the other cannon, all at the bridge. In the field to the southwest of the hill were 50 German troops with some Tories, and to the southeast were 50 Jaegers. 150 yards south of the other side of the bridge were 150 Tories, positioned behind a breastwork. Finally, the Indians were placed on a plateau behind the hill to hopefully keep them out of trouble. Baum basically had spread his entire force all over the field. Breaking his army into smaller pieces was poor planning, but to make matters worse, some of the units were over a half mile away from each other, so that there was no quick way to get to each other. Now, if you wanted to position men at the bridge, men on the hill, and the Indians would take up a reserve position on the plateau directly behind the hill, then that makes a little bit more sense. But these random pockets of troops in fields and in groves in the area, it never made sense to me. So this was really poor planning on Baum's part. So Stark was joined by Seth Warner, who was coming down from Manchester ahead of his regiment. At about noon on the 16th, Stark began to move his division. He ordered Colonel Moses Nichols with 200 New Hampshire militia to take a long route around Baum's left. At the same time, Colonel Samuel Herrick would lead 300 Vermont Rangers and the Bennington militia to the right of Baum's position. Colonel David Hulbert and Thomas Stickney with 200 men would move against the Tory position to the south. And lastly, 100 men were to demonstrate in front of Baum's position to keep his attention there. Stark kept over 1,000 in reserve to make the principal attack when the forces were in place. So while he's moving his troops around, he has a group of 100 men standing in front of Baum. Baum's attention is on those men. I don't know when they're going to attack, but they're right there staring at me. What he doesn't know is that there's 1,000 more right behind them. And when they start making their demonstration in front of them to distract him from the troops moving around his flanks, those 1,000 men are going to come up and they're going to plan to encircle the British and German forces. The Americans were able to move through the woods quickly without being noticed until they were almost to the rear of Baum's position. Baum, however, did not think they were rebel forces. So he was given some bad intel from Skeen. He told him that there was a 5-to-1 ratio of loyalists in the area, so they must be coming to support or they're seeking refuge. So his argument was basically that one out of six people here are rebels. The other five are going to be loyalists. So we have that working in our favor. These men are coming to help us. That's what he's telling Baum. Except that's not really true. Nichols and Herrick are the men that they see through the woods, and well, they're getting in position without any resistance whatsoever. Once they opened fire on Baum's position, it was a signal to Hobart and Stickney to start their attack against the bridge. Stark, hearing the attack starting, mounted his horse, ordered the principal attack to start. He is quoted as saying, "We will beat them by nightfall, or Molly Stark will be a widow." So as Hobart and Stickney attacked the Tory forces to the south, the Loyalists fired a volley and then retreated in good order, as did the Canadians in the cabins at the bridge. The Indians, once the opening shots were fired, completely scattered because they weren't expecting a full-blown engagement, so they make for the hills and run. All that remained were the forces on top of the hill under Baum, and there the fighting grew real hot. The Americans scrambled up the hill, firing as fast as they could. Men were said to have burned their hands on the barrels of their guns. That's how fast they were firing. Some New Hampshire men got in a position and were able to take out the crew on the cannon that was up there. So once they took the cannon action, it really shifted the balance in their favor. And as ammo ran out, many of the forces in Baum's position on top of the hill would cut and run. Now, those that were loyal to Baum, his cavalrymen, would stay even when the ammo ran out. They simply unsheathed their broadswords and prepared to cut their way out. But the swarming Americans were too much, and when Baum is killed, his men gave up the fight. Stark thought that all that was left was to gather the prisoners, policing up supplies, but the fight was not quite over yet. You see, Baum had sent word to Burgoyne the day before, calling for reinforcements. He was in dire need of reinforcements. So he sent Lieutenant Colonel Brayman with 650 more men, plus two more artillery pieces, to go and support. Traveling on the road was slow, and it took them a couple of days to get up to even close to Baum's position. And by 4 o'clock on the 16th, they were still 6 miles away at the Sanicoix Mill. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but that's the name how I read it phonetically. Stark learned of Brayman's approach. He needed to meet this new threat, but he had promised his men spoils of war, so they were completely scattered. He gathered as many as he could and sent them towards Brayman's position. The first party met the Germans about a mile from the battlefield. To Brayman, they just looked like scattered groups of farmers. Of course, Skeen, who was still alive and still advising, told him that they were loyalists, but when they took position behind a rail fence, leveled muskets, fired, killing Brayman's horse, well, Brayman figured out that they were not loyalists. Brayman ordered a detachment to dislodge the men behind the rail fence. Out broke out a series of running skirmishes. Stark was still trying to get men organized, but they were too spread out, and he was not going to be able to support the troops that he sent against Brayman already if he doesn't get more men. In come Seth Warner. Of all people, urged him to wait. His men were marching from Manchester, and they would be here soon. He was moving down from Manchester with 130 militia and 200 rangers. And when the Manchester men arrived, they traded fire with the Germans, but as night neared, Brayman decided to call off the attack, but the Americans were not giving up that easily. They chased as many of the Germans down as they could until dark. Brayman is able to escape with merely two-thirds of his men. The battle at this point is over. 207 Germans were dead. 700 more captured. The Americans captured four cannons, a load of muskets, over 200 broadswords, ammunition carts. All of this was going to really hurt the British, the way the British make war. This was the first time that the Americans got a really good look at the Germans in the Northern Theater. If you look at the tale of the tape, the Germans were professional soldiers. They had seen war before. They had fought in battles before. The colonists, not many of them have fought in wars, and even fewer of them have ever picked up a firearm in anger towards another human being. So to say that the Americans dealt a crushing blow to the British Army in the North is a complete understatement. They really had a handle on the situation. I'm going to read the numbers back one more time. 207 are killed, 700 are captured. With double the amount of men, the Germans would have a complete distinct advantage, but the American commander is able to not only capture 100 men, but he did it at the cost of 30 men killed, 40 wounded. Over 1,000 of Burgoyne's forces have now been swept from the field. The Indians, for the most part, don't return to the army. They saw how the battle went for the British at Bennington, and they decided that they were just going to head back into the woods. A lot of these Indians had come down from Canada, so they wanted to head back up so that they would not be implicated in any further military disasters by the British. The other thing, too, is they spent all that time looting and pillaging, and they weren't getting the spoils that they were, you know, had planned for. So that's something else that you have to consider when looking at the impact of the Battle of Bennington. As for Stark, on October 4th, Congress gave him a thanks for his service, and they made him a brigadier general in the Continental Army. The Battle of Bennington is one of three turning points in the American Revolution. People who are fond of the Battle of Bennington will say that without Stark's intervention, without New Hampshire and Vermont turning back these 1,000 men and helping contribute to the reason why so many Indians will abandon the army after the Battle of Bennington, had everything to do with how Stark led the field, how bravely his men fought for their homes and their lands. That's relative. We have to look at the other two battles for this campaign to really look at the true turning point of the American Revolution. And that's something that I think after I discuss them all four of them, I'm going to put a poll up and see of the battles and in one case, the one that isn't a battle, of these things, which is the most unanimously important to the cause and really turn the tide against the British, which one is it? So the Battle of Bennington, huge victory. 1,000 men are taken from Burgoyne's army. Most importantly, the Indians are scattered. Now they don't have to worry about those staunch woodsman fighters, because now all that's left is professional troops and some Tories and Canadian militia. The Americans can fight on their own terms, and having the Indians gone is going to give them that opportunity. So that's the real, what we really take as a basic outcome of Bennington. That's what it gave us. 1,000 men gone, especially those Indians. So that's things that we have to consider when discussing turning points in the war. As for next episode, we are going to shift again. We are going to move away from Burgoyne's army, and we're definitely going to move away from the Continentals along the Hudson, and we're going to shift to a different area of New York. But no less important than the Battle of Bennington. We're just going to have to decide if this next battle is one of our four turning points of the American Revolution. Okay, till next time, I want to thank everyone I hope everyone had a great 4th of July. Please remember, I don't do this for monetary gain. I don't do this for any other purpose than I want to teach people. I want to teach people about the history of the American Revolution. You will not be quizzed on this. You will not be, you know, expected to know every fact about the American Revolution. And the reason I make these episodes so short, this episode isn't so short this week, but the reason I make these episodes, you know, short episodes, and I don't make hour-long podcasts, is because I want people to just get a taste. I want people to say, hey, you know, talking about Bennington was cool. I want to learn more. And what I really want to do is hope drive people to picking up a book and reading about all of these great battles and events that take place during the American Revolution. It's been a while, but one of the books I'm going to recommend is by Eric Lazader, and that is The Battle of Saratoga. This is a pretty good book. I've read six books pertaining to the Battle of Saratoga, and this one tells a very good story. I have read about six books on the Battle of Saratoga and the whole campaign around it, and this one does a good job of telling a good story while not drowning you in facts, and that's something that I really like about it. So it's definitely a good book for those who like to read history books but have a hard time weeding through too much facts and too much of that like that military talk where they discuss in military terms how the battle plays out. There is other books like that out there, and I'm going to recommend one in the coming weeks that is like that, that for those of you that love military history, like reading books with that military form. There are ones out there, and then there are ones out there that almost read like a recreation book, but they're nonfiction. So it tells the authors do such a good job of painting a good story that it's almost like you're reading, you're not realizing you're reading nonfiction. So for this week, Eric Lazader's Battle of Saratoga is definitely that nice middle ground between the two. So if you're interested in it, might be a worthwhile pickup. Otherwise, I will have more books in the coming weeks. But till next time, everyone have a great rest of your week. And as always, keep the powder dry.